This hour at the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by You Build It. Stick around. In the next 15 minutes, I'm going to give you an opportunity to win a pair of tickets to Thursday night football at CenturyLink as the Seahawks take on the Rams. Stick around. I'm going to give you a code word where you can enter at KTTH.com. But first, let's find out what's trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
Two men visiting Seattle from Arizona on business were viciously attacked by a random stranger. It was completely unprovoked. And it's the latest story showing just how bad things have gotten in the city of Seattle, all thanks to a mayor and a council seemingly more interested in sending out a whole bunch of press release telling us how much they care about the city rather than implementing policies that show they care about the city. I know I've said this many times, but let's just confirm it one more time. Producer Peyton, I'm not asking you to dig up these kinds of stories, correct?
No.
No, they're just kind of there.
Yeah.
We're just seeing them because they're happening every single day in the city of Seattle. And boy, are we starting to see that creep of crime and homelessness getting out of control, going from Seattle to Kent to Bellevue to Sultan to Everett. It's happening all across this region, and it's happening because we're not treating this with the urgency that it deserves. Jesse Murray has been charged with second-degree assault for the attack that happened on 9th Avenue near Pike Street. It happened last Monday morning. Now, apparently, Jesse Murray admitted to the attack that was captured on surveillance video. This all according to the charging documents from Cairo 7 TV. Right now, he's still in jail with an arraignment scheduled for next week. Alan Washburn is the businessman from Arizona who was brutally attacked. Here he speaks to Cairo 7 TV.
We're probably about 50 feet away from the corner. And then the next thing I remember, I was talking to a police officer.
Because he was knocked out. Charging papers say SPD found both men, he, Alan, and his friend, with bloody faces. His friend's lip was busted. His friend, his co-worker, suffered a broken nose. Both men were transported to hospitals.
Had a couple black eyes and was still having trouble breathing out of one side of his nose.
Imagine you're coming to the city and having to deal with this. Imagine for a moment you're coming into Seattle, a place that you're told is really beautiful. It's a great place. Oh, this is the place that dreams are made. Come to Seattle. Great food, great people. People aren't so good, but they're all right. Food's all right. Come over here, hang out. This is a world-class, vibrant city. That's what Mayor Jenny Durkan says all the time. And yet this happens way too often. Why does it happen so often? Why does this keep happening? I ask that, and I'm going to keep putting out these stories. I'm not going to stop, even though I'm getting bored of them. I'm not going to stop because it's important to shine a spotlight on what's happening in our own communities. And it's happening because we allow it to. It's happening because we keep putting in power the same types of politicians. You know, we talked earlier on in the show, 3:30. If you didn't listen to it, if you missed it, download the podcast, please. Mike Solon, Officer Solon. This is a SWAT officer. This is an officer with 20 years on the job. And he's seen a whole bunch of different administrations come and go. And he's at a point where he believes, it seems, that the soul of Seattle is on the line. It's a line that we hear from Saul Spady on his morning show almost every single day. The soul of Seattle, and really I would go as far as to say this region, is on the line right now because you have a bunch of people in power who do not care enough to actually tackle these issues. They do not care. If they cared, we'd get more than press releases. I get a press release from Jenny Durkan's office almost every single day. Now, a quarter of the time, she's just complaining about Donald Trump, something that has nothing to do with what's going on in Seattle. And all the other time, oh, we're a world-class, vibrant city. People need to feel safe. What are you doing to make people feel safe? We still very clearly have a staffing problem with the SPD. We've got a city attorney who refuses to actually do his job and put bad guys in jail. You've got a council that yesterday expressed concern that we might put people who disobey their parole orders in jail. They're mad about that. They think that's too rough. We shouldn't be putting people in jail. So I'm not going to act surprised that we get these stories every single day, but I am going to start reminding you over and over and over again about the importance of this upcoming election. Phil Tavel is running in West Seattle against an incumbent in Lisa Herbold, who is a disaster. an ideological disaster. And yesterday, we had Mitzi Johanknik on, King County Sheriff, who decided to come out and endorse Phil Tavel. She's endorsing him because she realizes what this council has done to the community and to policing, and we need to step up and do something about it. Egan O'Ryan is running against Shama Sawant. He's a progressive, man. He is a deep progressive. He's nowhere near the crazy that Shama Sawant is. He understands business and he understands cops. You have Ann Davison Sattler running against Deborah Juarez, another incumbent. Ann Sattler cares about the community. She's met more people in the community than Deborah Juarez has after years of being in office. These races matter. And the implications to this region are going to be felt. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? You can't make this up.
Kamala Harris, senator from California. She, I think, is in fifth or sixth place right now. She's running for the Democratic nomination. She's an attorney. Imagine for a second being an attorney who has no understanding of how the First Amendment works. She is in a position of power. She's a sitting senator. She's running for president. She might be the nominee. Probably not, but she might be. Crazier things have happened. And she goes on TV on CNN with Anderson Cooper last night and says Twitter should kick Donald Trump off of their service because he's abusing his rights to free speech. Imagine being an attorney, someone who's supposed to understand First Amendment rights and First Amendment principles. Imagine an attorney saying this.
The president's tweets and his behaviors about this are just further evidence of the fact that he uses his power in a way that is designed to beat people down instead of lift people up.
Just real quick, that has nothing to do with whether or not someone should have the right to access a social media platform in which they can speak freely in a way that they feel is necessary. Now, if you don't like the way Donald Trump tweets, and count me in as one of the people who don't necessarily like all of the tweets. Sometimes I like him because I know he's trolling people like her, but sometimes they go a little bit too far and I don't like it. You don't get to decide what content should be allowed on a platform that you should have no role in deciding.
Frankly, when you look at what he's been tweeting today, directed at the whistleblower, directed at so many people, I frankly think that based on this and all we've seen him do before, including attacking members of Congress, that he frankly should be, his Twitter account should be suspended. I think there is plenty of now evidence to suggest that he is irresponsible with his words in a way that could result in harm to other people. And so the privilege of using those words in that way should probably be taken from him.
Yeah, we should take away your privilege because you might say things that might get people to act out in a certain way, which is very interesting coming from someone on CNN, a network that has repeatedly referred to Trump or Republicans as Nazis and white supremacists. Should we stop that kind of language? Because I have a general fear of what people in Seattle would do, for example, to someone like me who's gay and Jewish but has been labeled a Nazi and a white supremacist or a sympathizer simply because I've come out and said Antifa violence is wrong. Now, I'm allowed to be called a Nazi and a white supremacist by losers on Twitter that identify with Kamala Harris, but she wants to stop the president from being able to speak. And what's interesting about all of this is even Brian Stelter over at CNN is saying, yeah, come on, this is all about raising money.
Twitter is pointedly not saying anything. They do have an abusive conduct policy, and certainly some of the president's tweets, he screams presidential harassment. We could argue that some of those tweets may constitute harassment, but Twitter has never found any of Trump's tweets to reach that point. There's also a world leader exception, or at least a world leader policy, that says some tweets could be kept up, even if they are abusive, if they are in the public interest. So Twitter's not ever taken action against the president, but I think Kamala Harris is channeling her fans' feelings, her audience's belief, her voters belief that the president is so far out of line that something has to be done. I also think this was a very effective fundraising ploy for her. You know, the hour when she was on with Anderson last night, it was her best fundraising hour of the month.
So that should be alarming to folks. She's making money off of the idea that she would be silencing her political opponents. That's not what you do in democracies at all. That's not what we should be doing here. If you don't like the tweets, unfollow, block, mute, do whatever it is you want. Don't vote for the guy. But we shouldn't be deciding that, oh, I don't like the way he's talking, so he shouldn't get a chance to. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text on the Numb Better Tax Resolution Hotline. In about 30 seconds, I'm going to give you that keyword. so you can enter to win a chance for a pair of tickets to this Thursday night football match between the Seahawks and the LA Rams. If you're listening to the Jason Rand Show, go to KTTH.com right now. Click on the post to win a pair of tickets to Thursday night football. The code word for tonight's matchup, for tonight's contest, is snarky. Because that's what people call me, snarky, S-N-A-R-K-Y. Snarky is the key word. Go to KTTH.com for your chance to win a pair of tickets to see the Seahawks host the LA Rams for Thursday night football this Thursday at CenturyLink. The key word, one more time, snarky. Go to KTTH.com for your chance to enter to win. Let's find out what else is trending.
It's trending. Happening now.
Posado's Safe Haven responded to a rather disturbing dog hoarding case in eastern Washington, and now they've got 32 dogs that they're trying to help get adopted to forever homes. Apparently, I showed up today not expecting to adopt dogs, but now I feel like I need to adopt 32. That's how intense this story is. Joining me on the line live is Posado's Safe Haven's lead investigator. She works undercover, so we're withholding her name. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So can you take us through exactly what you guys found in eastern Washington?
Well, it's a pretty grim scene. It's something you'd imagine out of a movie. But this is a single wide trailer. All the windows have been blacked out intentionally by the person living in there. About 50 dogs were in there a number of months ago, like 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. And this woman had those 50 dogs in there for 8 years. They were reproducing over time, obviously. It didn't start off as 50, but those few dogs she had reproduced into 50 dogs, and she never let them outside. So a typical hoarding kind of behavior, mm-hmm. Very possessive of the animals as her property, and those 50 dogs lived inside that trailer for about 8 years, never going outside.
How did you guys first learn about this?
So you might still imagine.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
How did you learn about this?
So we got a call from a local person that lives near there. They had called every state agency they could think of, the Sheriff's Office, Department of Health, Department of Ecology, Adult Protective Services, you name it, mental health. They called everybody, pretty desperate. It was an older couple in their 70s. And they just, in all their work to find help, someone referred them to us. And so when they called us, they didn't even know, you know, who we were, what we could do for them. And we, of course, you know, explained that they need to call the sheriff's office, but soon realized that they already had done that. I reached out to the sheriff's office. They did not want to pursue it. And they had gone to the property and taken 20 of the puppies from this person, like I said, about 2 months before we got the call, and didn't go inside, didn't pursue any investigation, took the 20 puppies, and that was the end of it. So these people were really desperate mm-hmm. for help for the animals. This property was their property, and this person had pretty much manipulated them. Like I said, they were elderly, and they were going to let her stay there for a couple days. It was going to be 3 days, and they'd been trying for this many years now to try to get her out of there. And the state agencies they had called had told them that if you're providing her with water and food, she's your problem, so we can't help you. So they were just wow. beyond knowing what to do. And of course, we're not going to allow those animals to suffer in there. So and we were able to get them all out.
Well, I'm glad you guys were able to step up. Obviously, now there are 32 dogs at least that are in need of a home. PosadoSafeHaven.org/dogs if you want to learn more about how you can adopt. Now, you've made me want to adopt these dogs. And so the question is, you know, what condition are they in? Because obviously when you're in a position like this, there's this assumption that the dogs are going to be pretty aggressive.
Well, yeah, no, they're not aggressive at all, and I'm glad that it's making you want to adopt them. Oh. We would love that. So they're actually in okay condition looking at them. We do have open sores. We have quite a few deformities in their legs. Looking, it would look like a very bow-legged animal, or legs that are very oddly formed. And that's just from the genetic mutation of having a small number of dogs breed into that large number of dogs. We have some eye injuries and ulcers in the eyes. But behaviorally, they're super sweet. You know, they're scared because they've never been outside. Imagine this is something similar to a horror movie where someone's been locked in the basement for 8 years. These dogs have never been out in the light, in the sunlight. They haven't gotten to touch grass. Very basic stuff they are not familiar with. So they're going to have to learn that stuff. They do know stairs, which is great because some hoarding houses, the dogs are not familiar with stairs. She had built little ramps and walkways around the ceiling, in the ceiling panels of this single wide trailer. It was very unusual. That was what she called their indoor play run. But a lot of dogs were also caged up in very small makeshift wire cages, kind of made up out of wire and board and cloth. But the behaviorally, they're just scared and unfamiliar, but you can pet them, hold them. They're very loving.
PosadoSafeHaven.org/dogs if you want to take up one of these adorable dogs. The photos will make you want to rush to Monroe to check out these dogs. We're talking about pugs, beagles, chihuahuas. How difficult is it going to be to sort of, you know, sort of train these dogs to you know, realize that there's grass, that there's light?
I don't think very difficult. I think potty training will be the first thing that might be a little bit of a challenge because, again, they've never gotten to go outside. So they didn't learn that. But in my experience of over 11 years of doing this, I've found that, honestly, it might sound crazy, but a lot of these animals, they are so grateful and very eager to please. And so if you give them some time and some training, I don't think it's going to be that hard. I think you're going to find that you're going to have a real loyal dog pretty fast because they're so grateful to be out of that area. And even seeing it yesterday, seeing their reaction when they could have been, you know, a bit aggressive or just stoic, they were very responsive and appeared to be interested in their surroundings, which is a really good sign. So I don't think it'll be hard. I also will say that our policy at Posadoes is if you adopt an animal and for some reason it just doesn't work out for your family or for the animal, we are happy to always take them back, no questions asked. We want to make sure that the people and the animals get their right home.
Absolutely. And again, look, there are going to be some issues that you're going to have to deal with. And if you're that type of person who's got a heart of gold, but also a lot of patience, it seems like this would be the good move for those of you out there who have been looking to either add to your family or adopt for the first time. Again, PosadoSafeHaven.org, a wonderful organization out in Monroe. They've got 32 dogs that are in desperate need of some help. These are dogs that have been abused like no. I'm disgusted by this story. And just a last question for you, like, how does it get this bad without anyone stepping in?
It's pretty crazy, right? I see it all the time, but it never ceases to amaze me. It's mental health sickness. I mean, this person is very ill. She's very confused as to her reality. I mean, she doesn't think she is, but she felt that she was giving them a great existence. And hoarding is a psychological sickness. So I've seen animals that are deceased, and the person still believes them to be alive. So it just depends on the level of sickness, but clearly, no reasonable person is going to keep animals in this condition and have it be okay. So, you know, it needs to be dealt with differently, though. We're always working to improve and up-level the system for both enforcement, prosecution, and then also sentencing because, you know, she needs mental help, not you know, necessarily jail and fines, but she needs some mental health help.
Well, as other people focus on that aspect, we'll focus on getting some homes for these 32 dogs. Again, PosadoSafeHaven.org. Go there now. Get information on these dogs. If you can, open up your arms to them. And if you can't, you know what? PosadoSafeHaven.org will take some donations from you so they can help with all the great work that they're doing. We've been talking with their lead investigator undercover, so we're not giving out her name. I really do appreciate you stopping by. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your interest, and thank you so much for helping us get these animals their homes.
Absolutely. It's such a sad story. Again, PosadoSafeHaven.org. Go there now. Spread the word, especially if you guys know anyone who might be looking to adopt dogs. Posado, P-A-S-A-D-O, safehaven.org. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show live in the Online Trading Academy studio. Stick around in about 10 minutes. Russell Wheat is going to stop by. He's a council member over in Sultan. He's going to talk about some of the ways that they are handling crime and homelessness there. But there's a story that's actually going to be live tomorrow at KTTH.com that I'm going to give you a sneak peek at. Because if you believe 2 plus 2 equals 4, understand that if a student who's asked that question in a public school in Seattle says 5, you better not correct that student. Because if you do, you're an oppressor. Math in Seattle schools will become a social justice course. But that's not all. Got some more great news. U.S. government is going to be posited as a racist institution that must be destroyed and recreated. If this ends up actually getting taught to school students, this is indoctrination at its most destructive. An ethics studies advisory committee under the Seattle Public Schools superintendent, they published a preliminary math ethnic studies framework document that was populated by district representatives all across the state. These are educators. And it explains that math is a racist study that's used to oppress people. And if you dare correct a student's faulty math, you are guilty. This is social justice warriors taking over our school districts. The framework created by various statewide districts, it tackles four themes. I've got the document right in front of me. The four themes: origins, identity, and agency. That's number one. Power and oppression. History of resistance and liberation. And reflection and action. For math. For math. At its core, there is this belief in this document that, quote unquote, Western math is viewed as the only legitimate expression of math identity, and that it's used to, quote, disenfranchise people and communities of color. And as a consequence, it, quote, erases the historical contributions of people and communities of color. Oh, did you know that it does that? I didn't know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Now, of course, this has nothing to do with anything you should be teaching in a math class from K through 12, but that's what they're looking at. Apparently, math is now subjective because this framework document asks, where does power and oppression show up in our math experiences? Who gets to say if an answer is right or not right? Who gets to say if an answer is right? Who are you to insist 2 plus 2 equals 4? How dare you, sir? It goes on to say, who is smart? Who is not smart? Can I answer?
Yeah, go ahead, Jason.
Thanks, Mr. Behrens. Thank you. I really appreciate it. The person who says 2 plus 2 equals 5 is not yet smart and should be corrected, even if you think it oppresses them. Because we'd like to put them in a position where they could be labeled as smart. This is not difficult to understand. The framework believes math is manipulated to allow inequality and oppression to persist. It says, who is doing the oppressing? I think the answer to that is supposed to be a white, cisgendered, heterosexual Christian male. I think that's the person who is oppressing folks in math. Just FYI. They don't give the answer. They just ask the questions. I'm answering the questions.
Oh, good job.
Thank you. They ask, how has math been used to resist and liberate people and communities of color from oppression? So ironically, by the way, if you subscribe to the social justice worldview of math, which is, of course, ridiculous, if you teach anyone that there's no such thing as a correct answer, you will be doing not just immeasurable harm, but I would argue you're probably oppressing students. Now, if you thought that it's crazy because it's math, don't worry. They also get into history. The radical educators aren't just looking to redefine the study of math, but they seem ready to use history courses to present what I can only describe as an aggressively progressive worldview. And they're using the socialist activist Howard Zinn to indoctrinate these kids. So in my hand, see, it's really here. I've got the U.S. History Ethnic Studies Framework, which insists, quote, the United States government was founded on racist intellectual premises and economic practices that institutionalized oppression of people of color that continues to the present day. Still happening. And the document doesn't hide any of their goals here. They want to demonize capitalism. They call it exploitative. They call it oppressive. In one piece, it says that mass incarceration is now, quote, the new Jim Crow. Oh, my God. It wants students to understand that, quote, Europeans brought the dominant worldview values of guns, the Bible, private property, and social hierarchy, and racial supremacy. Now, I think that when we're talking about how a topic like this can be taught in school history specific, I do think that reasonable people can argue that history has been whitewashed, that we would all benefit from a more honest and holistic approach to how contemporary society has been shaped. I think that that is fair. I think we should do that right now. We should see how there were things when I was in history class that some of it was just wrong. But this document of what equates to possible recommendations to go to teachers, it goes way beyond that. This would be teaching ideological perspectives. This isn't teaching history. This is teaching propaganda, and you're trying to get students to think a certain way. Now, the school district got back to me. They sent me a rather long email, most of which I'm going to publish tomorrow in my piece over at ktth.com. And they want to point out that, you know what, this is not the committee's recommendations. These are just the notes, essentially, of all the work that's been done by others so far. They held their first meeting yesterday, a part of this committee. This committee, by the way, was created by the Democrats in Olympia, who mandates this. And it's all about creating an elective studies course at public schools. And they note, at this time, it would just be, if they do it, an elective class offering. At this time, there are no requirements to have these courses. Do you think if we continue to give Democrats power in Olympia, it's going to still remain an elective? Or do you think the goal of this is to legitimately teach students this kind of propaganda? This should alarm every single person who's got a kid in a public school in Seattle. And frankly, it should alarm everybody else who has kids in a public school. I don't care that you live in Monroe or Kenmore or Mukilteo or Everett or Tacoma or Longview. This is going to spread. Bad policies of Seattle have the tendency to spread. This is a horrific, horrific move. And once you get social justice warriors power, once you give them power in these committees, then it gets to the superintendent's office. And by the way, the superintendent's office already has a lot of that. The woman who sent me a note via email from the superintendent's office wanted me to know that her pronouns are she, her, and hers. This stuff is already spreading. So the question is, what are you going to do to make sure that it doesn't get to your community? And what can you do to help us here in Seattle make sure that this doesn't continue? This is dangerous stuff. And here's the kicker in all of this, and I look at this bit of news I'm about to tell you, and I'm actually proud. There are progressive activists. There are deeply progressive people that I know, hardcore progressives, who look at this, and they're embarrassed. They're embarrassed. And so one good thing that can come out of all of this is shining a spotlight on this to embarrass reasonable people who may still very well vote on the left, but they're the ones who are going to help us fight this kind of nonsense from spreading, because reasonable Democrats don't want anything to do with this, and they're going to fight along with us conservatives against this nonsense. Tomorrow morning at ktth.com, we'll have the blog. I'm actually not going to be on the air tomorrow, so I'm not going to be able to pitch it, but Jason Matera, who's going to be in for me, producer Peyton, said he was going to force to talk about this, and I appreciate that.
No problem.
1-800-465-8770. Send me a text, Jason Rancho. Welcome back to the Jason Rancho on AM 770, KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. As crime and homelessness impacts bigger cities across Snohomish County, it's spreading to some of the smaller areas surrounding the county, in the county, that don't necessarily have the same resources as, say, Everett to battle these issues. So some cities are getting a lot more creative and collaborative. Joining me on the line to discuss is Sultan City Councilmember, mayoral candidate Russell Lita. Councilmember, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jason.
So how has crime and homelessness impacted Sultan?
So we've experienced a lot of the similar issues as other communities across the county and across the region as it relates to homelessness and drug addiction. And one of the unique things about a small community like Sultan is that by nature of being small, the issue seems more visible. We don't have as many, you know, public spaces. And so those in the community who are homeless, who are addicted, are congregating in these places that everyone drives by. And so the impacts seem, you know, much bigger in a community like Sultan than, say, in a larger city like Everett, where those populations are concentrated in certain areas.
And obviously, because of how close the community is, I mean, when you see neighbors dealing with these kinds of problems, you feel even more concern for the greater problem.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, whether you're bringing your kids to the library, going to school, coming to City Hall, and you're driving by some of these places and seeing this, and it's certainly something that folks have taken an issue with, an issue that I hear on the doorstep quite a bit.
So how much of this is an extension of what's going on in Everett or even in Seattle? Is this something that is sort of more homegrown, or do you see it spreading from some of the bigger communities?
I think, you know, from Sultan's perspective, we've got folks that travel up and down the Sky Valley, so Monroe, Sultan, Gold Bar. A lot of it is homegrown. I don't know that we see a lot of it coming out of Everett. As you mentioned earlier, a lot of the resources and services are in the bigger cities, and so those folks generally tend to stay there. But what we've noticed is that when we come in contact with someone who might want help or want services, they don't want to go somewhere else for that. We've got one example of an individual who was ready to get help. We brought them into Everett. They got into temporary housing, and they ended up right back in Sultan, and it's because they weren't comfortable somewhere else. Their path to recovery wasn't easy leaving the place that they knew as home, and that was Sultan.
So, okay, so then what do you do in cases like that? Because, you know, you don't have Everett money, you don't have Marysville money, you have Sultan money, and that's not that much when talking about this kind of issue.
Yeah, I think the important piece is collaboration with our neighbors up and down the valley. You know, Monroe, the city of Monroe has tried out the embedded social worker program that's been a huge success in Marysville and Arlington. And so I've proposed and will be a leader for collaborating with the city of Monroe. I already started having conversations with some of the folks down the road to bring that program to Sultan and pool our resources, because what we've seen in the past is when one city cracks down on this issue, we're essentially just squeezing the balloon. We're pushing them up and down the Sky Valley. And so if we're not, you know, tackling this with a unified approach, we're not going to get anywhere.
When you're talking about the embedded program, just for folks who aren't aware, this is something that we've promoted very, very frequently on the show, thanks to Mayor John Nearing over in Marysville. The idea is essentially you've got an officer and a social worker of some kind, and they go up to people who are living out on the streets, breaking the law, and they say, look, you've got two roads to go down. I can arrest you and put you in jail, or you can work with the social worker. We're going to get you the resources that you need so that you're not living out on the streets, you're not addicted to whatever drug or alcohol that you're addicted to. We'd prefer you take option number two, but we're willing to throw you in jail if we need to. Has there been any resistance to that idea so far?
So right now, we have, with a contract with the sheriff's office, access to some of those resources, but it's not been a concerted effort. And there has been some resistance on the part of the current administration in Sultan to go down that path. I've led the charge on council, and we haven't quite gotten there. So I think as mayor, it's something I'm going to be able to really push. And the important thing for people to notice, because I think there's resistance among the public to the embedded social worker program on its surface, because it seems like we're coddling folks. And really what the important piece is you've got to have that strong arm of the law behind it. These people who are addicted, they're in this state, they're not going to come to help easily. And so there's got to be that motivation. That motivation is arresting these people and putting them in jail. And so when you explain that to people, there's more of an acceptance of it, because it doesn't just look like we're coddling folks. We're actually getting them the help they need, and in the long run, saving money on the law enforcement system.
And so take us through how you would be saving money, because I imagine someone might say, if they're in Monroe to this plan, well, we don't want to spend Monroe money on an issue that's really being caused by Index or Gold Bar or Sultan. So you're basically saying if all of the communities get together and pitch in the money, it's basically a wash.
Right, because if we're actually looking at the long-term cost of one individual in the community, you know, especially somewhere in Sultan, one person could be causing the majority of the thefts or the property crimes in a given week or month. And so if they're stealing to sell for money for drugs or whatever, if we get them into housing, get them into treatment, then they're not going to be causing those problems down the road. That's law enforcement time, that's prosecutor time, mm-hmm. that's court's time, that's jail time, and cities pay for all of that. And so in the short term, there's resources up front, but these resources exist. We've got resources that we just need to better connect people with. And so by taking those folks off the street, preventing that cycle through the criminal justice system, we're saving those resources.
So last question for you, I like to ask everybody who's running for office outside of the Seattle area, is do you generally have a fear of bad policies of Seattle sort of making its way into Sultan and your general area?
Yeah, I think that absolutely the policies of Seattle have their way of creeping out. I think we're probably far enough away that we're not too much at risk of that. And we've got a good council and good community leaders that are really focused on Sultan and what we need to be doing. So I don't think we're in too much risk of that right now, but it's certainly something that I noticed.
Yeah, and the good news is we've got leaders like you who are actually in positions of power. This case in the Sultan City Council, you're running also for mayor of Sultan. You advanced past the primary. You actually came in at the number one spot. I know you're campaigning hard. You are the exact kind of leader that the city of Sultan needs. So thank you for coming on the show as always, and we wish you the absolute best of luck as you're tackling these issues in a community that's seeing what a lot of other communities across the state are seeing. And we know that if you put together some really smart policies, they can be run efficiently, but also deliver results. So, Russell, thank you so much for stopping by. I really do appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks again, Jason.
Absolutely. Again, that's Russell Wita. He is running for mayor of the city of Sultan. He, of course, is also a council member there. You've been listening to the Jason Rancho. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really do appreciate it.